All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning, March 15th, 11 a.m., well, 11, 12 a.m. now, and we're doing Chem 12A. And I've been sitting here this morning trying to decide what I wanted to lecture on, because there's two things that I want to do, both of which I really enjoy doing. One is to discuss the co-ops and to give you some skill sets to help you with the next co-op that I want you to do, and that harkens back to configurations and looking at rotations and how to actually go through and calculate rotations and do that. And I have a co-op that I want you guys to do on that. And then the other one is stereochemistry and going on and looking at stereoisomers, which is also a really enjoyable topic. So both of these I enjoy. And I think we can do both today. I'm chomping to get at stereochemistry because it's so much fun. But the calculations are pretty good too. And I don't want to get too far away from the rotations, from the conformations that we were doing before giving you that co-op and sending you off on that. So let me do a little bit of that. I think that's the right thing to do here. And let me get that set up and screen share and show you how we're going to get into that. So that's what I need. All right, so what I'm screen sharing right now is the Chem 12A homepage. That's the cooperative assignments. I'm going to back up to my homepage that's there. That homepage, down at the bottom, when you look at it, it has Cabrillo Home, it has the NAS division, it has Chemistry Home, and it has the C4 project and the C4 web server. The C4 WebMO server is where we do that computational chemistry. And regardless of what page you go to, it's at the bottom of every page. So even if you hit the links that take you to our Zoom recordings, where all the recordings are, which I know that you guys go to daily, or at least weekly when you're watching the lectures, you can see that it's right there at the bottom too. And if I go back to the cooperatives, it's at the bottom of the cooperative page right here, where I have conformations of alkenes and cycloalkanes. So let me take this guy and look at it. It's supposed to be conformations of alkanes and cycloalkanes. Here, what I have is a number of activities that I want you to go through and do. And there is a PDF here that explains a tutorial on looking at dihedral angles. And that has a series of steps for you to go through to do, to be able to do the calculations that I'm going to ask you to do. It walks you through exactly how to do them. In addition, I think I'm also going to go back to co-op one, because this co-op has an introduction in how to use the WebMO application that I'm going to show you. So a little bit about why I have these computational components and why they're in cooperatives and why we didn't go back and do this originally. And the answer is that as well as being an organic chemist and a boron chemist, I'm also to a large degree a computational chemist. And my graduate studies encompassed a broad range of areas that I enjoyed in chemistry. And early on in my career, I had a grant from the National Science Foundation to promote computational chemistry and to develop computational chemistry exercises in order to teach organic chemistry. And we had a conference where we invited people from all around the United States and had a weekend conference where we discussed activities and things. And part of that grant from NSF, from the National Science Foundation, allowed us to be able to purchase software and a server to run it on, all of which has been upgraded and changed now, but the foundation of those exercises are still here, and I still use them, and I upgrade those exercises periodically. But it bought the original software, which is WebMO, and WebMO is a HTML front to computational packages. Most of the computational packages that are out there don't have graphical user interfaces. They are text-based, and we oftentimes write and submit the calculations as a text, as a text document. And the output that comes out of those programs is also text-based, which means that we need some sort of viewer to be able to view them. WebMO was written by a professor at a college in Michigan. And it's an extraordinarily good user interface. And it allows people to do computational chemistry anywhere in the world using this HTML interface. And so I have accounts that I use for different colleges that different professors have worked with me in the past. And we have set up accounts on this server at Cabrillo that we house at Cabrillo. And they're from all over the place. And they use this server throughout the year doing computational chemistry. Some of them are using my exercises. Some of them are using exercises that they developed on their own. In any case, the way it works is we go to Cabrillo College. You sign in with your last name. Actually, I'm going to create accounts for everybody. The account, I'll explain in an email. I'll put it out. But it's going to be your first initial last name. If you have a hyphenated last name, I just use the first part of the last name. The password for everybody is going to be chem12, all lowercase. There is no user information that goes into this system. It simply is an account that allows you to be able to do computational chemistry. I think that the only piece of user information that goes into this is possibly your email. That's if we choose to use it so that the system can notify you when your job is completed, but the jobs complete instantly. They complete within half a second. And so there's not even a need to have your email associated with this. And there's nothing that really needs to be protected. So you can change the password if you want, but chem12, all lowercase, everybody's got the same password. It makes it easy that I can go in and I can look at the jobs that you've run. I can assess those jobs. I have other ways to go in and look at those jobs, but I can assess those jobs. I can help you. I can run jobs in your account for you to show you how to do things. So let me show when you go in. Mine is under camera and there's my password. And when you log into this system, you're presented with a page. Yours will be blank if you're logging in for the first time because you won't have run any jobs. And there is new job, there is refresh, there's download, there's move, delete, utilities, log out. So your logout is over here. You can create folders to put things into. It's not an overly complicated system. Each job that you run gets a unique job number for the server so that your jobs will not be consecutive 1, 2, 3, 4. Your jobs will start somewhere in the 5,000s probably because that's what job we're on right now. And every job that gets run gets a consecutive number for the entire class essentially. To do a new job, you just click create new job. It comes up with the blank window here and a set of tools on the left-hand side. The set of tools, the first tool here, if you just mouse over it, it says build. The second one is a periodic table. That's a rotate, a translate, a zoom, an adjust. And then there's a series of tools that can be used once a molecule is created. I'm going to select the build tool. And then wherever I click, if you look down at the bottom of the screen, it says build carbon. Click to add, drag equals add bond. Click and drag equals add atom and bond. Letter equals change atom. So if I want to change atom, if you watch that C right there, I'm going to hit a capital B, it changes to boron. If I hit a capital H, it changes to hydrogen. If I hit a capital O, it changes to oxygen. If I need an element that has two letters, I do them in quick succession. Maybe I need BE, beryllium. I do a capital B, lowercase e, and it gives me beryllium. If I want to change atoms, I can also go to the periodic table and I can select it and you can see that it changes back to carbon. If I click the mouse, it will plunk down a carbon. If I click the mouse and drag, it will make a bond. So I can very quickly make a butane, or I can make a 2-methylbutane. And then notice that these tools over here now become activated. The first tool in line is a comprehensive cleanup using idealized geometry. Once I make the skeleton, I could go and try to put all the hydrogens in, but you'll find that it's a little bit tricky to put all the hydrogens in. So if I start, if I go and click hydrogen and I try to put three hydrogens on this, and then I look at what I did, we'll see that those hydrogens are all in a plane, not the nice tetrahedral that they're supposed to be. So adding the hydrogens to a molecule is sometimes difficult. Instead, what I do is I hit that comprehensive cleanup. It adds all the hydrogens for me, and it adds them in the proper bond angles so that they're all tetrahedral. And it will complete the structure for me, essentially, making my job super easy when I want to build something. If you want to start over, you can go to File, and you can go to New and delete it. And we can start over again at the Build menu. So we select Build, and oops, I'm in Hydrogen. So I made a mistake. So I'm going to go to Edit, Undo, Command Z. I will switch back to Carbon. You can do it again through the periodic table, selecting Carbon. Or I could have hit just capital C on the keyboard. It would change automatically. So there's ways to build quickly. Let's build an ethane. And let's add in the carbons. And so I'll hit that cleanup tool. There's also a wrench tool. I'm going to mouse over the wrench tool. It says comprehensive cleanup using mechanics. The other one says comprehensive cleanup using idealized geometry. The difference between the two is that the broom uses idealized geometry, meaning perfect bond angles, all 109.5 degrees for tetrahedral, all 120 for trigonal planar, all linear, 180 for things that are linear. The wrench actually goes through and does a calculation, and it uses what is called molecular mechanics. It is a combination of a database of bond angles, bond lengths, dihedral angles, common to certain atoms in combinations. And it tries to minimize the energy of the molecule, optimizing the geometry, thereby optimizing the geometry, using a very fast calculation. So if I hit this, it's going to look the same. It did a calculation for me, but it did it super, super fast. And you can see that I can rotate this. When I click the rotation tool, I can rotate it around as I want, and I can look at it in sort of a Newman projection. If I just wiggle it around in the right direction, I can see it as a Newman. When I want to go through and do a calculation with it, I hit the next arrow over here. This is the continue arrow. When I hit that continue arrow, it will give me a warning. It says the molecule is nearly, but not exactly symmetric. Continue without symmetrization. Sometimes molecules, depending on their symmetry, are supposed to be symmetrical, perfectly symmetrical. There is a tool over here that allows me to make the angles absolutely perfect symmetrical. It's not necessary always. I just usually ignore this warning and hit OK, and I just move forward. This is choose computational engine. You won't hit this window. I have two different computational packages that WebMO uses. One of them is called Gaussian, and one of them is called MOPAC. MOPAC is what is known as a semi-empirical calculation. Semi-empirical means that it uses a database of bond angles, bond lengths, dihedral angles, in combination with some electron-electron repulsions, nuclear electron attractions. It uses a combination of different types of calculations in order to calculate the thing that you're going to request it to do. Gaussian is what is called an ab initio program. Ab initio stands for first principles or from first principles. It does not have a database of bond lengths, bond angles, or dihedrals. It works strictly from molecular orbitals and minimizing the energy by placing the electrons into these molecular orbitals. The molecular orbitals are all constructed from linear combinations of the atomic orbitals. And it is a very big calculation. The calculation scales with the number of atoms that you put into it. And it scales exponentially. So that if I do a molecule that has maybe 5 or 6 atoms in it, it could take that molecule 10 minutes to calculate. If I do something that has 30 or 40 atoms in it, it could take days. Most of my computations that I do in Gaussian run 24 to 48 hours. Some of them run longer. And that ties up the server. So I use Gaussian for research projects when other students are not using the application. But for us, we always use Mopac. And I only have Mopac turned on for you. These types of calculations, even with a molecule that may be 30 or 40 atoms, are done in a second or two. And there's nothing you can do to tie up my computational server or damage anything. You can experiment and have as much fun with this as you want. You're not going to hurt anything. Once I click that server, it asks me for a job name. It always puts the molecular formula there. I like to change that job name so that I know what I'm going to do. This is ethane. And I think that with this ethane, what I'm going to do is I usually call it an energy optimization or minimization, but the program likes to call it a geometry optimization. So there it is, geometry optimization. So let's tell it we're going to do that. And then we choose the type of calculation we want. And there are all kinds of things that we can calculate. And this is just a very small option of things. Geometry optimization means optimize the geometry. It means try to get to the lowest energy for the structure that you can and optimize the geometry. Vibrational frequencies are like IR simulation. Transition state optimization is for reactions and looking at transition states. We'll talk about those later. Saddle calculations, IRC calculations, all of those things have to do with transition states. Coordinate scan is how I scan through a bond rotation, or sometimes when I'm doing a transition state search for a chemical reaction, I can use a coordinate scan to do that. We can also look at all the molecular orbitals. So there's lots of things that we can do. Geometry optimization is always the first one. The level of theory. These are what are called energy functions or Hamiltonians. These are different databases that are going to use different parameters to try to optimize the geometry or transition state or whatever it is else that we're calculating. I usually use either PM3 or AM1. I think most of the things that I ask you to do, I ask you to use AM1. PM3 is really good for hydrocarbons. AM1 is kind of good for everything. I think I'm going to stick with AM1. Our molecule has no charge. This is a neutral molecule. There's no ions on it. And multiplicity is complicated to explain. For everything that we're going to do, we're going to leave it on singlet. Let me show you, before I submit this calculation, let me show you the preview and generate. This is what actually gets submitted to the file, to the program, to compute. AM1, the Hamiltonian, bonds, charge equals zero, singlet, precise, G norm equals 0, 0, the name of the file, ethane geometry optimization. And this part here is a description of the geometry. It's called a Z matrix. It tells, relative to the first carbon, where everything else is placed. The first number that is here is a bond length. The second number that is here is a bond angle. And the third number that is here is a dihedral angle. And so it's what's called an internal coordinate system. It's all referenced off the first atom by bond lengths, bond angles, and dihedral angles. And these numbers that are out here at the end tell the atom connectivity. They tell which atoms are connected to which. So you don't ever need to look at that. It generates it automatically. But just so that you know, this is what it's doing. It's submitting an actual text file. And we could edit this text file, make it different, and it would submit that as the job. So I'm going to go ahead and tell it to go submit it. I'm going to hit the continue. It says this will submit the original unedited input file. I'm tell it okay. And now we can see that this is my ethane geometry optimization. The job is running. The time is 0 seconds. And if I sit here long enough, it will update, but there it did. It just took about 30 seconds. Every 30 seconds, it checks to see if your job is completed. However, this job took less than a second. If I were to hit the refresh button, it would have refreshed all the jobs and it would have shown me this job is being completed immediately. And so that you don't need to wait for it to update. You can always hit refresh. Now let's go see what our finished job looks like. We can click here. We can click the magnifying glass. Any of these will take us to the job. It doesn't look like anything was done. When I look at the molecule looks exactly as it did before, but now below the molecule are all of these calculated quantities. It tells me the job that was run. It tells me the symmetry of the molecule. It gives me the heat of formation, the energy of the molecule. It gives me the dipole moment. And if the molecule has a dipole moment, I'll be able to view that on screen. It gives me the partial charges on the molecule and which atom they are. And if I hit this magnifying glass, let me go back up and show you the molecule. I'm going to rotate the molecule a little bit. So I'll hit the rotation tool and I'll rotate it. In this view, each of the atoms has a number. That's the element number in the file that was calculated. Those numbers correspond to the atom numbers over here. These partial charges, when displayed, change the color of the atoms and represent the charge by both color and size. Watch what happens. I'll click it. The carbons each are partial minus. The hydrogens each are partial positive. And they're all identical, which is what I would expect for a molecule like this. If I want to reset the viewer so that I'm looking at what the molecule looks like, I can hit reset viewer right here and it resets it for me. All right, other things that I can do. I can investigate this molecule by choosing the select tool and I can select an atom. The atom gets highlighted and it tells me what atom I've selected, a hydrogen. It tells me the hybridization, none. It gives me a charge, zero. If I shift and click on the next atom, now it tells me the bond length between those two atoms. If I shift click on a third atom, it will give me the bond angle between the three atoms. And if I click on a fourth, it will give me the dihedral angle between those. If I want to start over, I can just click and get the dihedral angle in the forward direction and get it for a different atom. I can rotate it. I can go back and select them and investigate all the different things that I want. So I can see them as I want to see them. I can investigate the distance between any two atoms. Notice that I can select atom number 7 and atom number 5, and it will tell me the bond length, 3.101 angstroms. That's the difference between the 7 and the 5. They're not bonded, but it can give me that bond length if I want it. Also, if I click on 4, it will give me the angle between 7, 5, and 4 as a bond angle, even though it's not really connected in that way. So it's just calculating distances and angles, and you can choose any atoms to ask it for those angles that you want. And you can go through and you can investigate the molecule in that way. Let's take this molecule and let's do something different with it. Let's go through and do a coordinate scan with it. And I'll show you what a coordinate scan looks like. So remember that in the coordinate scan, or I didn't call it a coordinate scan. Remember that what I showed you was looking at dihedral angles and calculating energy versus dihedral angle. We could spin this as if it were in a Newman projection, and we could look at all the energies that come out as we spin this. To do that, I'm going to use this optimized molecule, and I'm going to hit new job using this geometry. This takes me to a new job file. And now if I try to scroll down, there's nothing down below this. There's no job information because this is creating a new job. The first thing that I'm going to do to run this to do a coordinate scan is I'm going to select 4 atoms and I'm going to make their dihedral angle 0. So let me show you what it looks like right now. Let me go back to my selection. I've selected the four atoms. You can see this dihedral angle. I'm going to adjust dihedral. I'm going to set it at zero, and I'm going to apply. It's going to spin the molecule for me. When it spins it, oh, I hit cancel, I guess. Adjust, dihedral, zero, apply, okay. Now the dihedral is starting out at zero, and it's in an eclipsed conformation, perfectly eclipsed, as you can see. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell it that I want it to go through and use this dihedral angle, and I'm going to spin it 360 degrees, and I'm going to tell it to calculate the energy at every step in the calculation. So calculate, tools. Hang on, now I lost where it is. Scan coordinate, there it is, under adjust. I'm going to tell it to start at zero and to stop at 360. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop it at 359.9, and I'm going to start it at 0.01. The reason that I'm doing this is because the program does not like to go through two geometries that are identical. If it hits an angle that is the same angle, the calculation will fail and it'll stop. And so what I'm going to tell it is, I want it to start at 0.001, different from zero, where the geometry is defined. And I want it to only go to 359.9 because I don't want it to go to 360 because 360 and zero are the same angle. And the number of steps, I think there's a limit of 200. I'm going to put it in at 100 steps. This means it's going to do 100 calculations. And I'm going to tell it, I want it to optimize the geometry at every one of those calculations. Then I hit OK. And it highlights what it's going to do for me. It's going to spin that dihedral angle and calculate 100 steps as it spins at 360 degrees. We'll take the job forward. Doesn't matter if it's symmetrical. We'll do it in MOPAC. We'll tell it that this is now ethane coordinate scan. And we will choose the coordinate scan. It already chose it for us, so we were all good. We're going to do it AM1, same as we did before, zero charge, singlet. And now I'll show you really quickly in the preview, just because I'd like you to see kind of what's happening. These are all the angles now that are listed that it's going to rotate through all those angles. So those are the 100 calculations, 100 angles it's going to go through. And this little number, where is it? That minus one right there is telling me that that's the dihedral angle. These four things that are right there, that's the dihedral angle that it's going to rotate, and it's going to change that angle where that minus one is sitting, and it's going to substitute in all these angles for that minus one. It's a little piece of information, you don't need to know it, but anyway, let's go submit it. Okay. This might take a little bit longer to run. I'm going to hit refresh. Job's done already. Did 100 calculations in that time. Let's go ahead and look at it and see what it did. So here's my molecule. It's back still in sort of an eclipsed conformation. Here's the job history, the number that it's related to. Doesn't have a symmetry because it's been rotated. Here's the heat of formation for the last calculation. Still the dipole moment is zero. These are all my simple charges and everything, but here's the coordinate scan. These are the angles. This is the energy of each one of those angles. And what I can do is I can hit the magnifying glass and I can view it and I can see the energy at each step as it rotated. And that's a beautiful sine wave, perfectly symmetrical as it went through each one of those steps. And so what I'm doing is I'm going through a staggered conformation, and then going up through an eclipsed conformation, back down through a staggered, up through an eclipsed. And it just rotates it through the 360 degrees. We can see the angle down here on the bottom, and we can see the energy in, I believe it's kcals per mole that it's giving us. All right. The other thing that's really nice, and I don't know if it's working for this, is most of the time we can hit the magnifying glass. Yes, it is. And you can see the molecule step through each one of the energies. The energy is related over here on the left-hand side. I can pause this animation. I can step it forwards. I can step it backwards. And I can get it and stop it at specific conformations and explore exactly that conformational energy, which is really nice, getting it right off the screen there. So it tells me the angle and it tells me the energy that I'm at as I'm stepping through. And so I can step through that animation or I can just let that animation play, and you can rotate it while the animation is going on to observe what's happening. So we didn't just do ethane when we did these. We actually put substituents on these as well. Let me go back to the job manager. Let me create a new job. Let me select an ethane molecule. Let's put the hydrogens on it. Let's change one of these hydrogens to a different element. Let's say that we want to see what happens when we put a fluorine on this space. So under the build menu, I'll go to the periodic table, I'll grab fluorine. And now if I click on any one of these hydrogens, it'll change the hydrogen to a fluorine so that I can replace the atom simply by clicking on the atom with the new atom, and it'll directly replace it. I'm gonna then clean it up again. That's gonna change my bond angles a little bit. And then I'm gonna go through and do that energy minimization first. So this is fluoroethane. And I don't want to do a molecular energy. That just calculates a single point energy. It doesn't minimize anything. I want to do the geometry optimization. I'll do it at AM1, zero charge singlet. We'll get that. And then let's go through and do the bond rotation with it. So here's my energy. Oh, dipole moment. Now I have something that's polar. Now I can show you the dipole moment, which is kind of sweet too. So we can look at this molecule, we can see it. We know that we have a polar element in here. The carbon fluorine bond is polar. Fluorine is more electronegative. I'm expecting a dipole moment, which is going to run pretty much from over here on this end of the molecule that's partial positive, running through the fluorine over in this direction to the partial minus. Let's hit that dipole moment. There it is. And you can rotate it and you can see the dipole moment and where it exists within that molecule in line with that carbon and fluorine. But centered through the molecule. The magnitude of this dipole moment changes. So the bigger the dipole moment is, the longer this arrow is. The arrow always points towards partial minus. The positive terminal end, always the partial positive. All right, reset. The other thing that I can do is I can look, I probably didn't hit reset, did I? Let's go back to the job manager. The job is still here. I hit new job using this geometry. I wanted to show you the partial charges real quick and how the partial charges change. The fluorine, now partial minus, but because of the polarity of the bond, the fluorine is sucking all the electron density out of the carbon. And I can see that this carbon now has a partial positive charge relative to what a normal carbon would have that has all hydrogens on it. So there's some really cool things that we can explore here. That fluorine changes not only the carbon, but it sucks electron density all the way out of these guys. But these guys are getting electron density sucked out of them as well. So let's reset the viewer. Let's go do our rotation. Let's first select hydrogen, carbon, and fluorine. And let's adjust that dihedral angle, make it zero. Apply. Okay. Let's then say adjust, scan this coordinate. Let's do the same thing that we did, 0.001. Let's stop at 359.9. Let's do it in 100 steps. Let's do it optimized. Hit okay. Take it forward. I know I'm going a little bit quickly here, but it's all in the tutorial, so you're going to be okay. Let's do it in Mopac. This is a fluoroethane coordinate scan. And it's already set up. We don't need to change anything here. When we told the computer we were going to do the coordinate scan, it set all these variables for us, which was really nice of it. We'll refresh. Still running. Refresh one more time. There, that job took 1 second. That took a little bit longer, a little bit harder to run. Now, when we look at the job, we can get the energy and we can view what that energy looks like. And that is looking darn symmetrical too, because I only have one substituent in it. I thought I was going to get two different, but I need to put another fluorine in it to get a different substituent in it. But we can rotate it now and we'll see it rotating a little bit more easily as it goes through each one of those steps. And that's really all there is to it. In terms of investigating, as I said, we could stop, pause it, and step through if we wanted to get specific energies at specific conformations. And we could put more than one substituent on this. We could put two substituents or three substituents, and we can go through and we can do the calculations and do the same calculations. While we're here, I might as well also show you, because this is a really nice thing to be able to do too, that we can go through and we can create different molecules that we want to investigate. And I can take, highlight an atom, and I can delete it. Cut. I can select that carbon and tell it that I want to change the charge on this carbon. I want this carbon to be a plus one charge. As a plus one charge, notice that it represents the carbon as a plus one charge. Notice now that if I hit the wrench tool, it changes, the molecule does not put the hydrogen back on because it knows that this is a carbocation, and it changes the geometry appropriately. It's now trigonal planar, it's now flat. And I can go through and I can ask it to calculate the energy of this. I can go through MOPAC and I can say, let's do carbocation. Let's do a geometry optimization. Let's do it at AM1. And now I need to put the charge in here of the overall molecule. The charge is plus one on the overall molecule. That is telling it that it's going to have one less electron than it would normally. And we'll leave the multiplicity singlet. I'll take it forward, refresh it, look at it. And as I scroll down, I will get the dipole moment, I'll get the symmetry, I'll get the heat of formation, I'll get all the partial charges. When I look at the partial charges, notice that that carbocation isn't a plus one in its partial charge, that while it is officially a carbocation, it's sucking electron density out of the carbons adjacent to it to stabilize it, reducing its charge from a plus one, spreading the plus one charge around the entire molecule. It allows me to be able to look at the bond angles and see what the bond angles do and the bond lengths. So I can check the carbon-carbon bond length. If there were more carbons in this molecule, I could go out and I could see how that carbocation affects the other carbon-carbon bond lengths. So there's all kinds of things that I can do once I get into calculating these types of molecules. And if I want to, here's another really cool thing. We can go and calculate the molecular orbitals just right here. And I can look at the empty orbital. That is not what I expected it to look like. And that is not what I wanted to show you, but that's really cool. The problem with that is that's the molecular orbital, not the orbital that I wanted. I wanted to show you a natural bonding orbital and what that guy looks like. And now that I said it, now I kind of go do it, right? Good job using this geometry. Take it forward. I'll show you how we do this really quick. Take it in MOPAC. Calculate molecular orbitals. AM1, singlet, carbocation. Take it forward, refresh the job. Now, oh, I didn't do the natural bonding orbitals. Maybe that's what's going to get me. I'm still going to get the same picture I had last time. I have to do this a different way. I'm not quite going to get it for you. All right, I'm going to let that go. I have to do it through natural bonding orbitals, and I didn't give you the ability to calculate natural bonding orbitals from here. I can only do that in Gaussian. I'll do that another time. The activities that I'm going to have you do don't have you do molecular orbitals, so you're good on that one. In any case, that's a quick overview of how to use WebMO. Every job that you create will be listed over here, which is why it's really important to give them accurate names so that you know what jobs have been calculated. Notice that that last job, I didn't change the name, so they both say carbocation. But over here, the description tells me one was a geometry and the other one was a molecular orbital. It's better if you change the name so that they don't have the same name. If you find you want to delete something, you can simply click on it and you can say delete, and it will permanently delete that job if something fails. Although when a job fails, it's oftentimes really good to understand why a job fails. And so to understand that, sometimes we could look at the raw output. We can go down to the very bottom of the file, and the very bottom of the file, which is really long, tells us why the job failed. Internal coordinate deviates, derivatives do not reflect Cartesian coordinate derivatives. To correct error, increase dihedral of atom 7 by 90 degrees. So the last couple of lines always tell you why the job failed and what you need to do to correct the job. So it can be very helpful to go back and see why a job failed. So I don't delete them too quickly. I always go through and look to see why a job may have failed and what I did wrong to try to correct it. So let me log out here. I'll say it one more time. When you log in, it's going to be first initial, last name, all lowercase. And then the password is going to be chem12, all lowercase. I'll try to get those set up later on this afternoon so that everybody has their logins. And then I'll assign those co-ops and create modules within the chem12 Canvas shell to tell you what it is that I actually want you to do and the time frame in which I want you to do it. So that's the WebMO part. Sophia, how am I doing? You can throw it in the chat if you want. Are there any questions in terms of how I went through that? I know I did it really fast, but the tutorial, as I said, when we go to the tutorial online, back at chemed.study. In here, under cooperatives, under the first one in particular, there is a WebMO tutorial. And so there's a link to the server, and there is a link to the tutorial, which then has you go through and do these different activities for this first co-op. And it has you calculating some carbocations and some alkenes and alkanes. It has you comparing and looking at lone pairs, and it has some files for you to download so that it gives you the orbitals that I want you to look at and walks you through the entire thing so that you can actually see the orbitals and what those orbitals look like so that you don't have to calculate them for some of them, but you'll be able to see them and view them and rotate them in 3 dimensions in real time. So, and then the second activity, which is the confirmations one that we were just looking at today. This also has the tutorial and walks you through each one of these activities that I want you to be able to do. So everything is going to be there for you. And I will link to those within the Canvas shell too. So you don't necessarily have to come back to this page. I will reproduce this or put links to it directly in there. Okay, that's the WebMO tutorial part. That gives us another 30 minutes to launch into stereochemistry. So let me stop this share and let's do that. Let me share the iPad screen.
It looks like one of those things I'll probably just have to play around with.
Absolutely. And what I would say too is that it is something that you can play around with. In other words, there's nothing you can break. There's nothing you can hurt. There's no time that you can tie up something for too long. And you have freedom to explore the application and to go through the tutorial and look at it and play with it. And if you screw up a few jobs and the few jobs fail, it doesn't hurt anything. You're not graded on your successes or failures. You're graded on completion for this assignment. So it's really about just getting the jobs done and getting there. So so there's nothing to lose. There's just lots to learn in terms of the application. And what's really cool about WebMO too is that I have a lot of different exercises that take us through, mostly in first semester, not as much second semester. But first semester, we walk through a lot of exercises that teach you about structure. And I have found over the years that students will continue to use WebMO through second semester. And I've had students that have gone on to UCSC and other colleges that have asked me to reactivate their accounts so that they can use it for the classes that they're taking at university, where they want to explore a molecule in order to answer some question that their professor has given them that they know that they can solve computationally. And it becomes a really nice tool to be able to go through and look at something. And if you don't happen to have your model kit handy and you want to build something computationally and then be able to rotate it and look at it and view it and compare it with another molecule, particularly for stereochemistry, it's super easy to do and super helpful. So it's like a virtual model kit that you can never lose, and you don't lose any of the pieces, and super easy to go in and use it anytime you want. All right, so don't be afraid to play with it. Okay, stereochemistry. Sometimes my pen, this pen in particular, decides that it's not going to write. Stereochemistry. We started this last class. We started looking at the different types of stereoisomers, and I gave a couple of different names. I said enantiomers and diastereomers. And I gave definitions for these. Enantiomers are molecules that are mirror images. Diastereomers are not mirror images. Basically, what's happening with these is they each have the same atom connectivity. But different spatial arrangement. If that spatial arrangement is such that the two become mirror images, then they are defined as enantiomers. If the two do not form mirror images, then by default, they're diastereomers. And that is the crux of it. However, there's a lot more to stereochemistry than just understanding what is an enantiomer and what is a diastereomer. So let's start off by looking at a molecule and this is a butane. And for this butane, let's look at these two hydrogens. The hydrogens are HA and HB. The two hydrogens are said to be enantiotopic. Enantiotopic means that if I take and replace the two hydrogens and I replace them with something else, let's say that what I do is I swap HB for a chlorine. So I'm going to take and make HB now a chlorine. And there's HA. And if I take and I swap HA for chlorine, I arrive at two different molecules. If I take and look at, and let's see if I can convince you that this is the case, I'll just throw a little bit of color in here. If I take and rotate this molecule about this axis, so that I take and rotate it, and I can actually, well, I can't copy and rotate it the way that I want to here, but what I can do is I can take and draw it in that rotated form. Then as I rotate that molecule, the chlorine is going to come forward and HA is going to go backward as I rotate it around. And I think you can see that I have simply rotated these two molecules, that they are the same molecule. And now that I've rotated it, if I bring that molecule down, I'm going to copy it. I'm going to paste it and show it here, that these two molecules are mirror images. Now, I know you're seeing HB and you're seeing HA, but if we ignore the fact that there's an A and a B, the chlorine being forward, a hydrogen being back, methyl group up, and the way that this thing forms, that these two molecules are mirror images, and as such, these are enantiomers. They cannot be placed on top of each other. If I try to orient them on top of each other, the hydrogen is in the same place as the chlorine, and the chlorine on the top molecule is in the place of HB on the bottom molecule. And they clearly have different spatial arrangements. So what happened by replacing HA versus HB, by swapping them with another atom, I created a set of enantiomers. And therefore, these hydrogens are said to be non-equivalent. And that's what enantiotopic means. Leading to enantiomers. And these two would have two different names. As I go through and I name these two different molecules, I can take and let's draw the two different molecules really quickly again. Is that HA or HB? This is HA. And the chlorine there. And the other one has the chlorine forward. And HB there. This one is plus 2-chlorobutane. And the other one is minus. Okay, the plus and the minus, these guys refer to a physical property of how the molecule reacts with light. We'll say plane polarized light. So that's what the plus and the minus refer to. And they're a way of distinguishing the two enantiomers. A way, there are multiple ways. We will look at that. So what's happening here? What's happening here is that as we start to look at these molecules, what we notice is that when we have a molecule that has four different things attached to the molecule. Let's say that this is A, B, C, and D. And these four things are different. This is said to be a stereogenic center.
Do you mind going back up for a sec?
Yeah. I'll do it this way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is a stereogenic center. Sometimes they short it and they say stereocenter. I think I'm guilty of using stereocenter as well, but stereogenic center is really the right term for it. What this does is it produces a center that has the possibility of being configured in two different ways. And as such, we say that this molecule is chiral. Chiral means an object or molecule, does not have to be a molecule, can be an object. An object or molecule and its mirror image are non-superimposable. That's what chiral means. Chiral, the word, really means handedness in where the word's original comes from. So chiral means handedness. And that handedness is just like your hands. So I'm going to stop the feed here for a second. If you take a look at your hands, you hold your hands up to the screen. Your hands are mirror images of one another. As I look at my hand, the thumbs are on the same side when the palms are facing each other. These hands are the same mirror images. But if I take them and I lay them flat and then put them on top of each other, trying to superimpose them, my thumbs are on opposite sides. My thumbs are non-superimposable. They don't fit back together as they do when they're mirror images. So when we say superimposable, both palms up, same orientation, slide them on top of each other, non-superimposable, thumbs are on opposite sides. Your hands are chiral, and that's where that word comes from. Handedness, chiral, meaning handedness, like your hands, non-superimposable. Your hands are chiral, essentially. So it is not a property simply of molecules. It is a geometrical property that many different types of objects have, of this idea of being non-superimposable. It just also applies to molecules. Okay, let me go back to the screen share. So when we're looking at this handedness idea, why is this important? What is it that's important about this? This goes back to a story about a certain molecule. This molecule was a drug that was developed in the, I want to say, sometime in the late 50s, early 60s. And it was a drug called thalidomide. Thalidomide has a stereogenic center in the molecule. I think I've drawn that right. That stereogenic center, that's aromatic, is right here. And this molecule is called thalidomide. The middle thalidomide was developed before the Food and Drug Administration was ever developed. And in that time, when drug companies created a new drug, the way that they tested the drug was to give it out to doctors. And they said, try this medication on your patients and please note down any side effects that your patients demonstrate and report back those side effects. And that was it. And the doctors then went ahead and prescribed this medication to their patients and tried to keep track of any side effects that happened. Thalidomide was a drug that was supposed to prevent morning sickness for pregnant women. And it was given out primarily in Mexico, but also in the United States, but more so in Mexico. Thalidomide was developed as what's called a racemate. A racemate is where I get 50% of one of the chiral molecules and 50% of the other, so that they are in absolute equal ratios. The problem was that your body, most of your biological molecules in your body also have a handedness to them, and that chiral drugs, drugs that have stereogenic centers in them, react in the body in different ways for the different isomers. One isomer can be a benefit. The other isomer can cause damage, can be interacted with in a different way. And it turned out that this drug caused birth defects, severe birth defects. And it caused children to be born without limbs. So they would sometimes be missing an arm or a leg or both legs or all of their appendages. And horrible, horrible birth defects. The drug did prevent morning sickness. One of the isomers prevented morning sickness. The other was the teratogen. The other one was the one that caused the horrible birth defects. And they didn't find out until months later when all of these children started to be born without limbs. So devastating story. It was one of the drugs that started the Food and Drug Administration and looking at the approval process that we currently have for drugs. And it was a woman who said that we just can't do these things anymore. And I'm forgetting her name and I need to look that back up so that I don't forget that. But she was incredibly important in going through and establishing a procedure for evaluating drugs and making sure the drugs are actually safe and that we do all of these studies in a very organized way, much in what we experienced with the pandemic and the vaccines and vetting the vaccines to make sure that they were safe for the public to be able to take and all of the studies that they need to jump through to prove that those medications are actually safe. So the thalidomide story is that it was the beginning of an understanding that drugs that have stereo centers in them, we need to handle them differently and we need to handle them carefully and started a whole study of stereochemistry and understanding stereochemistry within molecules. So what happens with these molecules? How are these molecules different? As I said, these molecules have the same physical properties almost entirely. They have the same molecular formula. So I'm just going to say same molecular formula. They have the same dipole moment. They have the same boiling point, melting point. Every physical property that you could measure, density, everything, they are exactly the same in all of those, all physical properties, except for one. That one is how they react with plain polarized light. So how they react with plain polarized light and why they react with plain polarized light is an interesting question. So looking at plain polarized light, what happens is when we look at light, light is a combination of a magnetic vector and a electronic vector. And so if we look at the way that light propagates this way with an electric vector. And then it has, and I'll do it in a different color, it has a magnetic vector. Let me do the line here first. That comes out this way. It goes back in space and comes out forward in space, and it's going 90 degrees. And so this is the magnetic vector. And the angle between these two is a 90 degree angle. So that when the electric vector is at a maximum, the magnetic vector is at a maximum. And this is what we call linearly polarized. When the light only travels in one direction like this. When we look at a light bulb and we think about how a light bulb works with a filament and the light that comes out of this light bulb. The light bulb comes out, or the light that comes out is not polarized. The light comes out in all different vectors. And so light is going in every direction as it emits out of the light bulb. But what we can do is we can take that light and we can pass it through a filter. We can take and we can create a grid of very fine lines. And what happens is the magnetic vector and the electric vectors that are not in line with the grid do not make it through. And so as the light comes through this grid, all other wavelengths directionally are knocked out. And this is what is called polarized. Plain polarized, polarized in a specific plane. That polarized light can then be passed through a sample chamber that has our material in it. That sample chamber is a tube. It has some ports for being able to fill it, and then it has some glass lenses that allow that light to be able to go through the tube. And the sample sits in here and is filled all the way up to the top of these wells so that it fills this thing completely and there's no air bubbles or anything else inside here. So this is the sample in solution. Or sometimes it's neat. Neat means absence of solvent. When the light comes out of this, and this is a chiral molecule, the light was in this plane orientation. It now gets rotated, and it gets rotated through some angle. We can call that angle not theta, let's call it alpha. Alpha is what they like to call it. And this angle can be measured using a detector. Simply by observing it, using another plane filter, using a filter like this that's on a rotator, and we rotate it until the light optimizes, and we can measure the angle from zero through which it is now rotated, and we can measure that angle alpha, and we can tell how strongly that light gets rotated. One molecule will rotate that light clockwise. The other enantiomer will rotate that light counterclockwise. And that is what is called the optical rotation. And so those are where the plus and the minus come from. They're experimentally determined and cannot be calculated ahead of time. So for every new molecule, we need to actually test the molecule to figure out which one rotates clockwise and which one rotates counterclockwise, and the degree to which it rotates. And that is called the optical rotation. So the question is, why does this actually happen? Why do these molecules interact with light in this way? And this is the really cool thing. But as we start to look at these isomers, what we can do is we can take and we can look at two isomers, B, C, and D, and let's make the mirror image over here. So there's B. Oops, I want that to be forward. And this one to be back. That's A. This is going to be D and C. These are mirror images. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to observe these mirror images. I'm going to look down the D bond. So I'm going to view down this bond here and look with D in the back. And I'm going to do the same to this molecule. And I'm going to look down the D bond. And I'm going to look down that bond right there between the carbon and whatever that substituent D happens to be. I'm going to look down that bond and I'm going to draw a Newman projection of what I see. So what I see when I do that is A is up, B is on my right, C is on my left. On the other molecule, A is up, but this is the mirror image. And so what I see is that B is on my left and C is on my right. Now what happens is as the plane polarized light moves, what we didn't talk about is the fact that light is not simply a linear vector like this, but light also has what's called a circular polarization. That if I think about how this light is propagating, as the light goes up in its electric vector and it comes out towards me in its magnetic vector, I can think of this as almost like a corkscrew, that it is coming out towards me and then going back away from me and then out towards me and back away from me. And so what happens is this makes, if I think about it, a corkscrew in the way that the light is traveling. The light is circularly polarized and or can be circularly polarized. The light, as it travels, travels one direction, this way, and travels this direction at the same time. If that light is to see the same thing going around the right side as it sees going around the left side, then that light will meet back up in the center at the same place. But what happens is the light doesn't see the same thing going around the right and the left-hand sides. Because the molecule is chiral, because the molecule has differences in its sides, one side interacts with the light slightly different than the other side. And so what happens is one side has a lower optical density. The light travels faster around one side than it does around the other. Let's say that the C side is faster and B is slower in their optical densities. Then what happens is, as light travels from the center point around the side A, it makes a longer arc. As it comes around B, it goes slower. And the light that was polarized in this plane originally gets rotated, and I get a new optical rotation. In the other molecule, C is faster, B is slower, and the same thing happens. Light comes around this side faster, this side slower, and I rotate the light through the same angle, but the opposite direction. So this was the original vector. This would be a rotation that would be counterclockwise. This would be minus alpha. And this would be a positive rotation. This would be plus alpha. And there's the origin of why the molecules interact with plane polarized light differently, is because of how light is circularly polarized and how it sees different optical densities as it travels one side versus the other. So the hard part then, we need to do a lot more work. I'm getting close to where I want to cut it for today, and we need to do a lot more work. But the hard part for us is understanding first what a stereogenic center is and how to identify it. And then number two, how to name it. So these are the two jobs that we've got that are going to be coming up fairly quickly. Number one, identification of a stereogenic center. Number two, how to name them. And chiral molecules. Identifying them, when we want to identify them, the stereogenic center is just a center with four different groups on it. So a stereogenic center is one with four different groups. And so our job then becomes to look at a molecule and to see if we can find when there is a stereogenic center. Now, most of the time, what you're looking for is you're looking for something that has this wedge bond and this hash bond and four different groups. And so if I have a chlorine, I have a bromine, I have a hydrogen, and I have a CH3 group, these constitute four different groups, and the star represents the stereogenic center, the center has chirality to it that can be in a mirror image. But most of the time, we don't represent the group that way. Most of the time, we don't always draw it with wedge bonds and hash bonds. And so what we can do is we can look at a molecule. I was going to do a ring system, but I'm not going to do a ring system. I'm going to put a double bond here, and I'll put a methyl there. And what we find is that when we look at this molecule and we go through and we say how many different things are attached to the different places in this molecule, there are three hydrogens. So every time I find two groups that are the same, that is not a stereogenic center. There are two hydrogens here. There is a CH3 group. And I could draw the hydrogen that is there. There are two hydrogens here. And there's a CH3 group out here. As I go through and look at this, every carbon that I see that has two groups that are the same is not a stereogenic center. So this one, not a stereogenic center. It's got two hydrogens, not a stereogenic center. This carbon has a methyl, a hydrogen, and two other big groups. The way that I can envision this is to see that group as being one, this group as being two, the hydrogen as being group number three, and this whole group out here coming out this direction as being group number four. That is a stereogenic center, the only one in the molecule. And so what we try to do is we try to visually see and recognize stereogenic centers in molecules when they don't have the stereochemistry drawn in. And that tends to be the hard part. So we need to be able to see this molecule as being a molecule which has a stereogenic center. And that's the location of the stereogenic center. And you're going to be asked to look at molecules and to identify all the locations where there are stereogenic centers in the molecules. And sometimes those molecules get complicated. So I'll just draw one real quick. We'll cut it at this. This is the last thing that I'll draw just to show you the complexity and how difficult this task could be. This is not a crazy molecule by any means. This is vitamin D that I'm drawing. So I'm just looking at the structure of vitamin D, and vitamin D has a number of stereogenic centers in it. It has a hydroxyl group, which is here. And when I go through and I look at all the stereogenic centers in this molecule, there is one that is here. There is one at the junction of the two rings there. There is one at the junction of the two rings there. There is one at the junction of that arm coming off and at that methyl. And so there are five different stereogenic centers in vitamin D. And I'll highlight out those stereogenic centers that I'm looking at. And being able to recognize those as stereogenic centers is one of the first skills that we work on in trying to be able to go through and just recognize where there are stereogenic centers. It is much more difficult on rings than it is on linear systems, but the skill set is the same. We'll work on some examples. I'll show you a bunch of examples later on when we come back on Thursday, and we'll do more of the skill set then. All right, that's it. I'm gonna cut it. Unless there's any questions, I'll let you guys go, and I'll see you tomorrow for lab.